This is Mae Brussel. This is part two of broadcast 714. I don't have to give the date again. Okay, it's August the 12th. The program is World Watchers. In case you picked up the first half hour, keep hanging in there. Take your pencil and make notes. And you can reach me if you have any questions. You can call or write letters. P.O. Box 22511. And I send a bibliography for each broadcast so you can look up the sources of information where I'm getting the information. Incidentally, for all the people that David Lifton gave credit for helping him with his book, Robert Ramphtel and Bernard Fensterwald and so forth, going down the line, Gary Mack, I suggest these names are well known, Harold Weisberger, write to them, some of them, and ask them if they believe that there was a double autopsy on the body of John Kennedy. And I doubt if they would say they believe that he had two autopsies. Even though they helped David with the book, there's been no wide support on this idea of the two autopsies. The background, incidentally, of David Lifton before he wrote this was he had a bachelor's degree from Cornell School of Engineering in Physics in 1962. He was a computer engineer at Space and Information Systems Division of North American Aviation, which was a prime contractor for the Apollo project, working for NASA, North America at night, and he was getting an advanced degree at UCLA in engineering when he was writing this book on the double autopsies. Now, back or on to the news of the assassination attempt on the Pope and the trial that's falling apart in Rome. I just have a few items that I want to share with you because it's impossible to take the stories that were in the newspaper this week and detail them. They're so long, each one would take its own broadcast. But I don't want you to pass these up in case you can get them at the library or from other sources. I just want to run down six or seven of the most important stories and what names were mentioned in the stories to whet your appetite, and I will share them with you pretty soon. One is called The Real Conspiracy Behind the Bulgarian Connection by Rachel Rubin. It was written in Daily World July 16th. She's doing some wonderful jobs on this subject. She talks about Francesco Pazienza and his work with the P2 and the Mafia and the Masonic Lodge. And it, with SIMSI, those are the main capital letters of the Italian counterintelligence group. She discusses the CIA funneling money to the neo-fascists in Italian, the congressional records on that. Paul Hensi of the CIA station chief in Turkey, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and the fanatical help of the Turkish Grey Wolves and the neo-fascist party, the PAN party, that Paul Hensi was also affiliated with and knowledgeable of when he was in Greece. Another two-part article, wonderful, by Jonathan Quitney, wonderful in details and names, rich with names, Wall Street Journal. He wrote a book this past year called Endless Enemies, and he did wonderful research on the Nugenhan Bank. And so August the 7th and August the 8th are two stories by Jonathan Quitney, both making the Wall Street Journal, so it is now kosher to criticize Ronald Reagan's Michael Ledeen and Claire Sterling and the team getting closer to Ronald Reagan's entourage when it breaks the front page of the Wall Street Journal and then into the back, and these are long articles. The first one, August 7th, is called Tale of Intrigue, How an Italian Ex-Spy Who Also Helped the United States Landed in Prison Here. So this story involves Francesco Pazienza, the fellow I've been talking about for many, many years, and his contacts setting off the Billy Carter smear that helped to get Ronald Reagan elected, his relationship to Bettino Craxi, C-R-A-X-I, and Ronald Reagan, their contacts as soon as Francesco Pazienza was arrested, his relationship to Alexander Haig, to Michael Ledeen, to Yasser Arafat, to Robert Armeo. Now, the contact of Pazienza to Armeo is interesting because Armeo is a Rockefeller aide, and he's the one that set off the Iranian hostage crisis that created so much pain for Jimmy Carter, and then they were released the day that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. So you have two people affecting Ronald Reagan's elections, one the Carter Gate story, and the other the hostage crisis. Also, the links of Pazienza to the French intelligence, to General Giuseppe Sandovito, and I was talking about him and Alexander Haig 4 years ago in 1981, and Sisma and Federico D'Amato, I don't know if he's related to the senator in New York City and Michael Sindona. Now, the second article by Jonathan Quitney, K-W-I-T-N-E-Y, did I give you that spelling? Part 2, Wall Street Journal, August the 8th, Why an Italian Spy Got Closely Involved in the Billy Gate Affair. And the working with journalist Michael Ledeen, Francesco Pazienza's role. Now, this has to do with his relationships to Muammar Gaddafi, who will also be affecting our election. He just gave millions of dollars to Mr. Farrakhan, who will split the blacks and break up the Democratic Party when it comes to the United States election the next time around, if there is a party. And I've mentioned this before. This article is about Alexander Haig and Michelle Papa, P-A-P-A. He was a part of Permadex operation, the group that killed John Kennedy to make way for Richard Nixon, the selected heir who couldn't win in 1960 against John Kennedy. He writes in this article about Arnaud de Borchgrave, who's become the editor of Reverend Moon's Washington Star, and the relationship to Ledeen. And he also brings in PLO and George Habash. And I mentioned George Habash a year and a half ago when I wrote almost 2 years ago on the murder of Larry McDonald and the links of Habash to the John Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King by way of Larry McDonald and the terrorists in the Middle East. He brings in the Alda Murrah murder, Michael Ledeen's connections to Grenada, handling the papers of Maurice Bishop, the Reagan administration links of Francesco Pazienza, Haig Ledeen to the State Department, and the meeting of Pazienza and Ledeen with Alexander Haig, who was president of United Technology at the time, December the 9th, 1980, Pazienza and Ledeen with Alexander Haig. Haig went on to become Secretary of State, but in case that date doesn't grab you, it was one day after John Lennon had been murdered. And I said immediately that Lennon was murdered to get out of the way so Reagan wouldn't have any protest for the war for a state that he was going to begin to escalate. So the Wall Street Journal, interestingly enough, makes note of a date of the meeting of Pazienza, Ledeen, and Haig, the three giants of disinformation and military coups, on the very day after John Lennon, was murdered. Another article, and I'll be detailing these, I just want you to know what's being thrown out in the air in the Wall Street Journal so you get an idea of some of the things that are coming down. Another article, The Bulgarian Link Full of Black Holes. This is a large article. These aren't just columns. These are half-page articles in the Washington Post by Michael Dobbs, dated July 28th. The trial of the century is coming apart. He talks about the failure of the Italian magistrate Ilario Martella to fully explore Ajah's right-wing connections. And this is exactly what happened with the John Kennedy assassination. They looked for Fidel Castro or the Russians in Marina, and they failed purposely, of course, to look for the right-wing connections, and it's the right that is there. Incidentally, one of the charges that Mr. Francesco Pazienza is being arrested for in Italy that they want him for is for blaming the left group, the left political parties in Italy, for murders and conspiracies that the right wing, that his own intelligence agency, committed. That should be a crime in this country. It should be called the Reichstag crime. I'll do more about it later, but Francesco Pazienza is wanted for blaming the legitimate left for doing crimes that he and the top people did. Now, the article in the Washington Post says that the newspapers and the TV centered on the Soviet bloc. And this is why it's so important to keep going back to the Kennedy assassination and always ground yourself in that, because that is what happened, going back to the Soviet bloc and not the media. As well as the intelligence agency, it was not exploring the possibilities of Lynn Marina as agents of the United States government. Certainly the evidence was all there. But even the left media did a pretty good job of covering it up or kept silent if it had to do with the others were charged with the Soviet bloc. The Washington Post says the truth for Ajah is not a historical fact. It is a commodity to sell. He changes stories and get out. That's what Marina Oswald did. She was a white Russian family, somewhat of means until the revolution came, the background there. She wanted to get to America and have a refrigerator and a home and all the material goodies she talked about. And selling a story is a commodity. Ajah isn't any different than Marina Oswald, and you have to see those comparisons as history moves along. The Washington Post says there was an inaccuracy of his descriptions. We know that. Of his knowledge of his alleged accomplices. There is no alternative. There is an alternative to the Bulgarian connection, according to Michael Dobbs. It is the Turkish connection. Now, Turkish is okay. Robert Keith Gray, the escort of Rosemary Woods through the whole Watergate, a Washington figure since the days of Eisenhower. A friend just sent me a book on Robert Keith Gray in the Eisenhower years associated with that White House and with Nixon. Gray is the public relations man now that has a client. One of his clients is the country of Turkey. But Paul Hensa in Turkey was a CIA agent. So again, the Washington Post is doing what it did with the Watergate or any other story, the Joseph Mengele or whatever you have, if you want to call it. If Mr. Dobbs wants to tell you that the Turkish connection is important, Hensa was CIA station chief in Turkey. Paul Hensa works with Michael Ledeen from Rome, Claire Sterling from Rome, Ledeen and Sterling from the right wing, from the American CIA. The whole thing goes back to the American intelligence plan and coups and murders. Turkey is a small factor. They used a man from Turkey who was a known assassin who wanted to kill the Pope when he lived in Turkey. But the plot has nothing to do with the government of Turkey. It has more to do, well, the people that let Ajah out and trained him and got him the gun and so forth, that part. But it has more to do with Western intelligence and Alexander Haig and the Reagan connections to getting Reagan elected than it has to anything going on in Turkey. Another story, New York Times, this is August the 7th. Turk denies role in papal shooting. This is a man, Sedat, S-A-D-A-T, Kedem, K-E-D-E-M, who's been brought to the trial by Ajah, who Ajah said he was involved in this plot. He happens to be a legitimate leftist, and he says Ajah is telling lies. I never was in Rome before until this day when I came to testify, and he has his passport to show it. He says Ajah delights in stories of Nazi camps and extermination of Jews. He wanted to learn urban guerrilla tactics. He praised people who murdered, and he was very much part of the whole right-wing fascist group that would welcome a fascist military dictatorship. Another story about the assassination attempt on the Pope from the New York Times, August the 7th. Pope's assailant testifies about letter to the CIA. This is Ajah, who sent a letter last month saying that Emanuela Orlandi, and we've mentioned this before, the daughter of a Vatican employee who's been kidnapped since 1983, is waiting for her freedom, and all that they have to do is free Ajah, and she'll be free. He says the gray wolves and the right wing have her. They want her out, not the left wing or the commies. The letter, he said, was designed to obtain help from the CIA because, according to Ajah, these are the men who believe in God. He said the letter was a simple blackmail that he wrote to the embassy earlier in the year, talking about freeing her, and the gray wolves would release this poor young woman, Emanuela, if the Ajah were free. Well, you can't blackmail somebody if they didn't do something wrong. So he's saying to the CIA, get me out, and then you can have her, and everyone will be happy. He's waiting for them to help him. Another story from the Daily World, July 25th, reveals CIA connections on Pope plot with journalists. And this, again, is by the same woman who wrote the other article for the People's World. And she is saying here that she talks about Paul Hensa of the CIA and his role in the covering up the story of CIA station chief in Turkey and worked with the intelligence people behind the plot of the Pope. And he tried to break the story and work with people in Europe on the sinister thing that the KGB planned this assassination attempt. This article cites Claire Sterling, that we've mentioned many times, who broke her story in Reader's Digest September 1982. Oh, Paul Hensa in Wall Street Journal of October 81 started the story, is the Soviet intelligence behind the plot on the Pope. He planted that as a journalist and being in the CIA in 81. In 1982, Claire Sterling began her story in Reader's Digest that sent her all over the country on radio talk shows, and she wrote for Rome Daily American, a newspaper which was founded by the CIA and then went on to work for the New York Times. And then Michael Ledeen, with his links to Francesco Pazienza and Licio Gelli, worked for a newspaper, Il Giornale Nuovo, a right-wing newspaper in Rome, then went to the Georgetown Center for Strategic Studies, International Studies, worked for Henry Kissinger, preparing an NBC a series that Henry Kissinger made, and also on NBC, you have Marvin Kalb. He's not included in this CIA connections, but Marvin Kalb is the Kissinger National Security Advisor. He links to the National Security, the CIA, and the State Department. He's now the spokesman for Reagan administration. He put on the NBC one-hour program on the KGB and the Bulgarian plot behind the Pope. So she's identified these people coming from CIA newspapers and right-wing newspapers. Then the New York Times had another story. Former spy says he warned the Vatican of assassination. Try Francesco Pazienza claims that after he left the Italian intelligence in 1981, he was working, still keeping up with people on the Eastern Division, I suppose, ones that he could smear later, and closely associated with those people until he was kicked out of Italy or out of his position with the P2 and the Masonic Lodge, and then fled or went into hiding. He worked with Alexander de Marinche, a French intelligence person who warned the Vatican that the Soviet would attack in 6 months, and he gave the information to Claire Sterling and Michael Ledeen. Mr. Pazienza and Sterling met with Pazienza and Giuseppe Sadovito. That's a gentleman that I have linked, Alexander Haig, for a long time, whose name is now in the Wall Street Journal articles. And so this plot that he knew in advance, he leaked to these writers, which was a typical CIA disinformation activity. Then finally, another article in the Daily World, July 16th, Bulgarian citizens demand relief of Antonov. They said he's been in jail for 2.5 years, locked up on these various charges, and they're all lies, all fake, and he should be out. Now, a lot of people have called KFJC and asked about the motive for shooting the Pope, who would be behind it. And I can refer to these listeners, they probably don't remember the broadcast I did in 1981, 2 days after the Pope was shot. I did a broadcast, it's number 493, Who Shot the Pope? Who Would Want to Shoot Him? And I listed the various possibilities that I thought would be involved or what motives, ruling out Muslims versus Christians. I didn't think a Muslim would shoot him, that one pope is the same as another, and he was friendly to the PLO and Arafat. There'd be no reason to shoot him. The second factor would be the far right, more fascist than the military government, and it turns out that the Italian intelligence, the very group that Francesco Pazienza and the others are involved in, is a secret government behind the regular intelligence system, the SISMI, CISMA, and that they are more right and were trying to take over the government for themselves. And I said that the far, far right, more right than regular Italian intelligence, would want to silence the Pope to make sure that he didn't interfere with future bloodbaths in Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Now, Aja said when he was arrested, I only wanted to warn him. I didn't want to kill him. If I wanted to kill him, I would have, and he has a record for having killed a publisher in Turkey already, for which he was sentenced with a death penalty. But there is this group that is far right, and the Pope has gone along. He's now talking in Africa about ending apartheid, so maybe he'll get another message, a near bullet. But this country was planning as early as 1941 to completely take over all of Central America, whatever it takes to do it, and they need the cooperation, of course, from the Pope, because terrible things are happening and are going to continue to get worse, and this Pope is behind these activities about 200%. Another possible conflict was the Protestant against the Catholics, because in this country there are a great deal of Nazis that are anti-Catholic, and shooting the Pope wouldn't solve anything, as I mentioned before, ruling out that motive. You get rid of one Pope, you get another. Another factor is possible interference with the Turkish politics and the economy, with the Vatican links to NATO and Ronald Reagan and Alexander Haig directing Turkey, dividing it away from the Muslims, half Christian, half Muslims, and particularly if it's linked to a narcotic war. And 4 years ago, I mentioned the narcotic war involving Richard Nixon and Alexander Haig and Ronald Reagan, the Watergate team, and they're paying off Turkey not to grow heroin while the Shah brought in the heroin. But then when the Shah was removed, the drug traffic again could come through Turkey, and through Marseille and the Corsican drug profits would escalate in this country. When the French connection was cut off, then another means of routing it has continued, if the French connection is cut off. But there were tremendous drug wars and problems in Southeast Asia as the Vietnam War was winding down, and the war from Afghanistan was cut off when the Soviet Union took Afghanistan, that path from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and into Turkey, moving through the arch there of narcotics traffic. There were drug wars coming down, and I think the Pope was in the middle of a political scene in those drug wars. Now, what I didn't know when I did that broadcast that adds to it, but which isn't much different, was that 2 days before that broadcast on May the 17th, just right after the Pope was shot, they were just about ready to make that swoop to arrest the members of the Banco Ambrosiano and the P2 and the links to this hidden Masonic lodge to the intelligence system. And I didn't realize that this was going on. That story broke May 29th of the link of Alexander Haig as NATO commander and his fellow Nazis involved as secret teams in the security clearances and in the intelligence system in government. And I listed five heads, one that had joined chief of staff. The other was Giuseppe Sanavito, the head of the military intelligence. That's the one that works with Pazienza and Ledeen and Claire Sterling. And the arrest for these people happened right after the Pope was shot. But I didn't know that the investigations were taking place since 1979. And they go to Mr. Paul Marcinkus and the Vatican Bank. So when this man became Pope, he inherited something that was already just about to be investigated. And so when the Pope was shot, May the 13th, and on May 24th, the P2 story broke open, the Masonic Lodge, the Lizio Gelli connections to the Odessa Nazis in South America, and the drug traffic going on down there throughout the United States and linked to the bank in Milan, the Banco Ambrosiano, and that complicated network of the largest bank in Italy, the Vatican, the Vatican Bank, the Vatican itself, the guns that were being shipped out, the drugs that were being brought in return, guns and drugs involving the highest religious order of the Catholic Church. All of this was happening, and as Ajah said, I really didn't mean to shoot him. So those are just a highlight, just giving the titles takes almost a half hour, but I can't pass them up because they do tie in, again, all these other articles that come out on planned coups and assassination plots go right back to this team and to Dallas, and they aren't different. They are part of the same fabric. Last week, I was talking about the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I'm sure you got plenty of that during the week. I don't want to dwell on it too much. I just want to cite about four articles that came out in this past week. One is a report charges that Harry Truman plotted the Soviet A bombing. Plans were drawn up by the administration of President Harry Truman in late August of 1945 for atomic bomb attack on the Soviet Union and for a post-attack occupation by 1946. These charges were made in Tokyo yesterday by a professor, Mr. Kaku, a nuclear physicist. He's now at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. The plans are contained in formally classified documents. The atomic bombing of the Soviet Union was to take place only a few weeks following the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There were plans for attacking the Soviet Union that were set down, called the Strategic Vulnerability of the Soviet Union to a Limited Attack, codenamed JIC-329-1. They were to single out 20 cities, including Moscow, Leningrad, Gorky, Tashkent, Novosibirsk, I don't know if I pronounced that right, and Omsk, as the targets most valuable or suitable for atomic bombing. This American government, ours, planned this large attack. The program called for Western allies to divide among themselves various regions. After we were to take over the Soviet Union, we'd send in 25 divisions, and they would be the Moscow-Riga Division, the Rostov-Novosibirsk, the Vladivostok-Irkutsk, and the Eastern Europe. And this was set up. We had, hypothetically, about only 7 atomic bombs in 1946, but by 1948, the new plan was called Operation Broiler. This would drop 50 atomic bombs on 20 cities, and that is the state of mind I have said many times over that World War II never ended. It was a continuation of policy. The only thing that changed, and this is very important, is that the idea that Rudolf Hess has, that the Allies line up with Germany, didn't happen until May the 8th, 1945, when we officially greeted hands. And Rudolf Hess is not in Spandau prison. We can talk more on that later. He set up all the South American policy for Martin Bormann, worked with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and a lot of other people is familiar with Dr. Urban, the Gestapo agent in charge of Errol Flynn. This war never ended, and that's what is on the drawing boards right now. Another article that came out last week apropos of the bombs was the United States planned how to blind the A-bomb victims. Some of the planners, this is in the San Jose Mercury, July 23rd, some of the planners of the atomic bomb of Hiroshima in 1945 suggested dropping a super powerful siren first so people would look up and be blinded by the subsequent explosion. The idea was discarded, but the documentary raises the point to illustrate how those who planned the bomb's use believed that terrible civilian casualties were needed to horrify Japan into surrendering. They were talking about what they called shock action, and that's why they chose a spot close to the civilian population. John J. McCloy, an assistant secretary of war at the time, said Hiroshima plus 40 years and still counting, that's the name of a program last week, talked about these decisions, John McCloy. And getting back again, John J. McCloy, making these decisions at that time, was a member of the Warren Commission when the President of the United States had his head blown over. Now that was 1946 that they were going to do this device. 1985, Monday, August the 12th, today. Army test blinding devices, Dugway Proving Ground, Utah. Incidentally, Dugway Proving Ground is where Dr. Layton, the father of Lawrence Layton, worked for many years with experiments of this type. His son has been charged and gotten off two or three different times for killing Representative Leo Ryan at Jonestown. We'll do more, update the Layton thing in a little bit. But getting back to Dugway Proving Ground, the U.S. Army researchers are pursuing what they call the universal obscurant, a device that would blind the enemy seeking to destroy a target. Testing of the obscuring agents is designed to foil missiles and smart bombs, but over the years, it really has to do with eyes. We're not blinding weapons. We're blinding people's eyes. This is what we started in 1945. Now, the Department of Defense is going to spend $325 million to improve the facilities over the next five years, working for what they call obscurance, you know, smoke obscurance, where you can't see. They'll add 300 slots to the 500-person workforce. The money's going in. 9 years ago, Dugway was the testing site for smoke and obscurance, and it tells about their testing at Dugway, Utah. Army testing the blinding devices. So one day you read that the government wanted to blind the people in Japan who looked up, and then 2 weeks later you read that the United States is going to spend $325 million on blinding devices. Now last week, I don't know if you read this, I saw in the LA Herald and no other paper, Paul Bregman, a crewman for the Nagasaki bombing, was found hanged. This is in Los Angeles, California. He left no note. The coroner is looking into the matter. There's going to be an autopsy, or has been, on his body. It seemed like an apparent suicide. He was a crew bomber on the atomic bomb run over Nagasaki 4 years ago. This Friday, he was found hanged in his home in Van Nuys. And it goes on about the bomb. He was not happy about the anniversary of the bomb dropping. He had some concern. He had some statements he made about it. Maybe he had statements to make that he knows about that we don't know about the intent. Anyway, on the anniversary of the bomb, August the 5th, the day before the Hiroshima bomb anniversary, he was found hanging in Los Angeles, California, and the LAPD from North Hollywood Division went over to remove the body. We'll never hear about that autopsy. The Los Angeles Times, August the 5th, tells about the horror of the bomb that haunted an officer throughout his life. The legal officer, First Lieutenant Philip C. Close, was aware of what happened when the bomb dropped in Hiroshima, bombs dropped in Nagasaki. He wrote to his family in Kansas City, "Buildings and people in the immediate vicinity are not blown to bits. They disintegrate and vaporize if you imagine such a thing, the outer extremities and all living tissue and material, organic and inorganic, is seared to destruction beyond recognition. Well, he grieved about this. He was an attorney, and according to the account, he went down to the boiler room of where he lived in the apartment to light the furnace, and it exploded. He was badly injured, and he was taken to the VA hospital, and he never pulled out, and he died November the 4th, 1963. He was 52. He died just 3 weeks before the assassination of John Kennedy. Well, our time is up. I had a lot more I wanted to do. I dwelled at length on the Lifton book because it's important, so we're going to have to leave these other stories for next week and get back to them. I'm sorry the hour's over. Hope it went as fast for you as it did for me. We'll be back. This is Mae Brussel on KAZU FM. I'll be back with you next week to continue with some more very important stories in the news.